Welcome to the Look Far podcast, Voices from the Wild. Join Look Far Conservation as we talk to conservation leaders from around the world about their work, their life, the challenges they face, and the successes they've had.
I mean, fair trade requires all of these things in terms of worker safety and health. It requires higher wages. And then there's this fair trade premium that comes back to the workers. And they've done extraordinary things. I visited a banana farm in Colombia, and they sell fair trade bananas to Whole Foods and Costco. And with the money that they got back, they were able to build housing for every single one of the 600 families that work on that farm. Now, it took a few years to happen. It didn't happen overnight. But the point is, those workers now have homes, thanks to your decision to buy that fair trade banana. And that's the cool thing about it. It's like you and I, as consumers, get to change people's lives one banana at a time.
Welcome to the Look Far podcast. Joining us this week, Paul Rice, the founder and CEO of Fairtrade USA. Paul, really awesome we could do this.
Yeah, Scott, I'm so excited. Great to be here.
All right. Well, there's a lot to talk about, and I kind of want to just get right into it. Fair trade is something that I think anyone who has been to the supermarket, been out shopping, they run into the fair trade label. But in a nutshell, Paul, how would you describe fair trade and what it does and how it helps people?
Yeah. Well, you know, as a consumer, when you see that fair trade certified label on a product, you're getting a great product that helps improve lives and helps protect the environment. I mean, it's pretty simple. Underneath that promise, underneath or behind the label, if you will, is a 300-point checklist, a standard with 300 points in it that farms and factories have to comply with in order to win the fair trade certification. And those farms and factories get audited every year. We send auditors out into the field. We're in 70 countries around the world, so our auditors go visit factories in Vietnam and farms in Peru, and they verify that those producers are meeting the fair trade standard. And when they do, those producers get certified, and that makes them eligible to sell with the fair trade label. And here's the punchline. If you're Whole Foods or PepsiCo or Patagonia or Walmart, any of the companies that we work with to buy fair trade products, you agree to pay a little bit more money. And that money goes right back to the farmers and the workers. So at the end of the day, it's that fair trade premium, we call it, that ends up changing lives. It allows farmers and workers around the world a little bit more money to invest in health and education and reforestation and clean water and housing and all of the things that are needed in those usually very impoverished communities. So bottom line, as a consumer, when you buy a fair trade product, you're making lives better, and you're helping those producers also to protect the environment. And the environment is a big part of our standard as well.
And, you know, fairtradecertified.org is your website, commonly known Fairtrade USA. You founded it back in 1998.
98. When you were just a lad.
That's right, if only. And back in 2018, celebrated your 20th anniversary in New York City at a cool event. I somehow managed to sneak into. I'm not sure I was on the guest list, but
that was a great party.
Had a good time at the party. But there are two things, Paul. I mean, one is that fair trade didn't start in 98, that it existed as a concept, as a model. It was being practiced.
Yeah.
What you did was something, you know, sort of new and different, and you took it off. But even before we get to that, you know, you didn't come out into the world as an infant knowing all about fair trade and wanting to do it. You had to go on a journey.
Yeah.
You had to go do some things and see some things. I wonder if you could take us on that, you know, walk us through that journey.
Yeah.
What led you to wanting to create, you know, Fairtrade USA?
Yeah. Well, you know, the short answer is in college, back in the late 70s, early 80s, I became very concerned about global poverty and environmental destruction around the world. And, you know, I was studying economics and political science, and I just became very interested in food and hunger and agricultural development. And so I decided by my senior year that I wanted to go abroad and get some field experience working with a cool project in the area of international development. I wanted to work with farmers. I didn't grow up on a farm personally, but my grandfather, my mother's father, was a farmer. He lost his farm during the Great Depression in Oklahoma. So I grew up with stories of, you know, these hardworking farmers that, you know, put so much effort into the food that we eat every day and who often don't really get rewarded for all that effort. And so I wanted to be a part of the solution. So at the tender age of 22, fresh out of college, I bought a one-way ticket to Nicaragua. And I went off to work with farmers in Nicaragua. I thought I would stay for a year or two. And I ended up staying for 11 years.
Nice.
11 years in the mountains of Nicaragua, way, way, way off the grid, working with very small family farmers. A lot of them were coffee farmers. And I worked on a lot of different cool projects that were funded by well-intentioned international aid agencies. But Scott, it was a very discouraging experience for me over as the years went by, because what I discovered was that top-down aid-driven model of economic development more often than not doesn't really work that well and often creates dependency on foreign aid. And so I started looking for solutions and different approaches. And it was in 1990 that I just kind of by accident, through a friend, heard about the fair trade movement, which had been up and running in Europe for a few decades at that point, right? So fair trade has been going in Europe longer than in the US. And what I loved about the fair traders is they had this really cool slogan, really simple: trade, not aid, right? And their philosophy was, if we want to fight poverty around the world, farmers don't need our charity. They don't need our aid. They just need a fair price for all the hard work that they put into their coffee or their bananas or whatever it is they're producing. So trade, not aid. So I was fascinated by that concept. I got educated. I wrote letters. I got more information. And finally, I found a fair trade buyer in Boston, Massachusetts, actually. So it wasn't in Europe, the first one. It was a company called Equal Exchange out of Boston, Massachusetts. And they said, hey, we buy coffee. If you can organize a bunch of farmers and ship your coffee to us directly, we'll pay you a fair trade price for that coffee. So I organized Nicaragua's first fair trade coffee co-op in the summer of 1990. We filled one container of coffee. It was just 20 families. We filled one container load with like 250 sacks of coffee, shipped it to Equal Exchange. They paid us $1.20 a pound. And after costs, that left us with $1 a pound to pay to our farmers. And here's the punchline. At that time, the local middlemen in the mountains of Nicaragua were paying coffee farmers 10 cents a pound for their coffee. Mm-hmm. We got them $1 a pound. So it was 10 times more money, literally, that we were able to deliver to our 20 families. And it was revolutionary. It was transformational. I mean, overnight, I became a very popular guy. I became Pablo $1, $1 Paul, because that was our promise. If you sell to the co-op, you'll get $1 a pound. And over the next couple of years, Scott, we built that into a 3,000 farmer co-op, 3,000 farmers. My last year running the co-op, we shipped over 120 containers of coffee. That it was extraordinary growth. And then we were selling to Europe, right? Almost all of it was going to Europe, Switzerland and Holland and England, countries that had been doing fair trade for years. And we were getting so much more money for our coffee that our farmers were able to do extraordinary things for the first time. They were able to repair rundown school buildings in the local community. They were able to dig wells and bring clean drinking water into their community. They were building health clinics and providing healthcare services. They were working on women's rights and reforestation and new soccer fields. And the punchline, all of this thanks to no one's charity. None of it thanks to a government program or an NGO. It was all thanks to a market-based model of a fair price for a great product. And so I was kind of an anti-capitalist up until that point. I kind of thought that the problem that poverty was rooted in market dynamics and that the market was the problem. And what I learned through that journey was that actually, you know, there is a way to harness the power of the market, to harness the power of consumer spending, to literally lift people out of poverty in a single lifetime. It was incredibly transformational for me, obviously for the farmers, but it changed my thinking about international development. And that's when I decided that my calling was to come back to the U.S. after 11 years in Nicaragua and see if I could kind of replicate what was happening in Europe and plant the fair trade seed in the U.S. and build a fair trade movement at scale here in the United States. And so that's what I've been doing ever since.
And when you founded Fairtrade USA, you know, the idea was to bring that, build a network of companies in the United States that would be buyers of fair trade products. And what I'm curious about is, it was different back in the 90s. A social enterprise like this would very much be something you'd do as a nonprofit organization. But, like you were saying, trade, not aid, there's a strong, sort of business rationale that runs through all of it, even if value is defined more than just in terms of dollars and cents, that value has a more integrated definition that brings in social and environmental and other considerations. But, you look at, and you guys are headquartered in Oakland. And if you look at, Northern California today, it seems like everywhere you look, there are all kinds of social entrepreneurs that are creating businesses that are very commercially oriented and they're very tech oriented and tech enabled, but seeking similar goals. So I'm wondering, if you think about the way this landscape has evolved the past 22 years, and then what might be in the future, for fair trade, it's hard to kind of stick you into that nonprofit category that you really have evolved into something else. And it could be a social entrepreneur company. It could be a tech company. I mean, what would you, even if the legal designation, in case the IRS is listening, is not going to change, what the nature of the organization, how does that evolve, going forward, given all you've seen?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So the audience may not know it. You do, clearly, but the audience may not know. Fairtrade USA is a nonprofit, 501c3 nonprofit organization. Our mission is to fight poverty around the world and promote sustainable development, including both social and environmental development. And we chose that model, a nonprofit model, early on because we appeal to a whole community of stakeholders. We appeal to companies and consumers and activists and farmers and workers and philanthropists. And so that whole stakeholder community is what is activated to kind of share a journey of building the fair trade market in a way that everyone benefits. And so we felt early on that taking financial self-interest out of the equation and doing this as a nonprofit would essentially allow us to accelerate the development of this fair trade movement. I don't have any regrets. For 1998, it was absolutely the right decision. But you're right that today, I think society is less judgmental about for-profit companies that are doing good in the world. In 98, if I'd done it as a for-profit, I think people would have wondered, what are they really up to, right? As a nonprofit, it was easy for me to say, we're doing this for the world. We're doing it for the good of farmers and workers and companies and consumers and everyone involved. If I had to do it, if I were starting the organization today, I'd probably start it as a B Corp. I started as a for-profit so I could raise, more investment capital and grow more quickly. But I would do it as a B Corp, a benefit corp, and I think everyone would understand that. Suffice to say, even though we are a nonprofit, we do kind of function like a social enterprise, meaning we work with the business community. Our model is a market-based approach to change, and actually 80% of our revenue comes from the service fees that we charge the industry for the services that we provide. Most of our revenue doesn't come from philanthropy. So it is a very interesting hybrid model. And, for anyone in our audience who is considering the world of social entrepreneurship and how to change the world, I would say it doesn't really matter whether you choose for-profit or nonprofit. Ultimately, it's your mission and your business model and how you create a model that both affects change and gives you financial self-sustainability, if you will. And you can do that in either legal construct.
Yeah, I think that's really true, that the legal designation is secondary to what you take as your mission and how you share that and describe that and who you seek to work with and how those relationships go, that's what ultimately defines who you are, and I think shapes the kinds of impacts you're going to be able to have. So let's do this. Not to get into a full-blown webinar about fair trade, although I think there are some available probably somewhere on the interwebs, but to go through kind of, you know, farmer, factory worker, you know, retailer, consumer, although it's probably for you not a lot of fun to generalize because, you know, you're so aware of the minute differences across different countries, different regions, different products, but like to maybe pick an insight or two in terms of, you know, how to sort of perceive and understand each of those stakeholders. Maybe start with the farmer, you know, and you know them well, you might know them best, but like your typical or even not so typical fair trade farmer, what's something that would be, you know, good to know that folks might not, you know, automatically get from just seeing, you know, a fair trade label on a product?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a great question. And I guess I'd start by just sharing that we now are working in over 70 countries around the world. So when you talk about farmers, we're talking about the U.S. farmer or the Vietnamese farmer, because we're working with both. I mean, we started with a real focus on developing countries, on the poorest countries. So we started initially only working in Africa and Asia and Latin America. We recently started now certifying farms and factories in the U.S. and Canada, and now in Europe as well, because as it turns out, you know, the plight of farmers and farm workers in this country is not so great either, and they need the benefits of fair trade. So we have now kind of fully embraced a philosophy that we announced a few years ago called Fair Trade for All. And it's the notion that any farmer or worker anywhere in the world in any product category is eligible to join our global community as long as they can hit that high bar of compliance around labor and social and environmental criteria. Anyone and everyone is welcome in our movement. So we're working in 70 plus countries around the world, and we certify over 40 product categories, starting with coffee. But now we certify tea and sugar and cacao for chocolate, and a dozen different, you know, fruits and vegetables. We also certify clothing and furniture. We recently launched seafood, and our latest product category is dairy. We partnered with Chobani to launch the first fair trade dairy product, yogurt, in the world. And so, you know, you will now find that fair trade certified seal in pretty much any and every aisle of the supermarket. And I'm very proud about that, because that's not really my doing. It's all those companies coming to us and saying, oh, wow, that thing you started way back when in coffee, can we apply it to the world of seafood or dairy or t-shirts? So it's an indicator to me that corporate America is increasingly realizing that sustainability and ethical sourcing is not just good values, but it's good for business. And so, you know, let's talk about the farmer experience. You know, if it's a small family farmer, the typical fair trade farmer is a small family farmer with maybe 2 or 3 acres of land. That's it. In the mountains of Nicaragua or the mountains of Peru or Ethiopia or the highlands of Sumatra, their main challenge historically has been that they've been exploited by the middleman. They don't have market access. They don't have electricity. They don't have computer. They don't have computers or internet access. So they don't know what the world price of coffee is, and they don't know what the value of their coffee is. So they sell to the local middleman, who drives up in a pickup truck to the edge of the farm with a fistful of cash and says, "Today's coffee price is 20 cents a pound. Take it or leave it." And so what fair trade has done is help those farmers get organized into typically co-ops or associations, and that enables economies of scale that allows them to process their coffee. And I'm talking about coffee, but it's also true for cacao or coconuts or bananas or any of the other things that we certify. By joining a co-op, and by the way, sun-kissed oranges and ocean spray cranberries are co-ops too. We have lots of farmer co-ops in America as well. Mm-hmm. But our farmers, when they form co-ops and process their own product and then sell direct in the international market, they're kind of, it's like fair trade is direct trade. They're jumping over the middleman and going direct. And that's really a hallmark of the fair trade experience for small family farmers around the world, a more direct connection to the market, which allows them to make more money, but it also allows them to hear market signals directly for the first time, right? The middleman doesn't say, I'll pay you more if you have high quality, but Pete's or Green Mountain Coffee, they, you know, they're saying to these growers, give me higher quality, I'll pay you for it. And so the growers, for the first time, have ears. They can hear the market whispering in their ears saying, go organic and you'll earn more money, or go higher quality and you'll earn more money. So what we're doing is building the entrepreneurial capacity of people who were preyed on in the past by greedy middlemen. And I'm very, very proud of that. I mean, it's not just about more money. It's about empowerment. That's the experience of the farmer. If you talk about the farm worker, and there's a difference, a farmer owns her land, a farm worker doesn't. So we work with farm workers in all of these countries that work on bigger farms and maybe making $4 a day or $8 a day, depending on the country. And, you know, there, the situation to solve is a whole host of worker rights issues, worker safety and health. Like, you're spraying the fields today. Did you get a mask? Were you trained in how to use the mask? Did you get gloves? Do you understand, you know, the risks of handling chemicals without this protective equipment? I mean, fair trade requires all of these things in terms of worker safety and health. It requires higher wages. And then there's this fair trade premium that comes back to the workers. And they've done extraordinary things. I visited a banana farm in Colombia. It was right before COVID, so it's been a couple of years now. And they sell fair trade bananas to Whole Foods and Costco. And with the money that they got back, they were able to build housing for every single one of the 600 families that work on that farm. Now, it took a few years to happen. It didn't happen overnight. But the point is, those workers now have homes, thanks to your decision to buy that fair trade banana. And that's the cool thing about it. It's like, you and I, as consumers, get to change people's lives one banana at a time. So that's the experience of the farmer and the farm worker, you know, accessing a model of empowerment and a better life for themselves through their work and through the market.
And then when we go to the retailer, you touched on it, you know, a bit earlier. There's a lot of interest. There's growing interest. And I think that, you know, it's hard to separate them because that's very sensitive to what consumers are thinking about and asking about and what's motivating, you know, their decisions. And this to me is where it gets interesting because, you know, depending on who you talk to or how you look at it, this can be, you know, a nonprofit, this can be a B Corp, this can be something that is, you know, in the middle of nowhere in the rural hinterlands and mountains of Nicaragua or whatever, or it can be on the shelves of Costco. And, you know, you can find, you know, pieces of the fair trade value chain, you know, all throughout. And, you know, it seems like to have been around for 22 years, you've always been able to stimulate interest on the retailer side. Maybe in terms of an insight on the retailer, what's changed from 22 years ago to now? Is it just simply more interest, or has the nature of that interest evolved and maybe gotten more specific or keyed on one set of issues or another, or maybe it hasn't changed at all? But I'm just, you know, from your perspective, how does it look looking back?
Yeah, I definitely feel like society is evolving and the corporate world is evolving. When I got started in all of this, I mean, back in Nicaragua in 1990, so more than 30 years ago, very few U.S. companies were thinking deeply about supply chain sustainability and you know, the well-being of the workers and farmers in their supply chain. And very few companies, for that matter, thought that Americans would pay a penny a cup more for a cup of coffee just to help some third world farmer. You know, that, you know, the belief in corporate America was that consumers were indifferent and that the supply chain was easily switchable and pretty opaque. So any kind of bad practices was never going to surface. And today, clearly that's not the case. You know, every developing world farmer and worker has a cell phone. So there are no more secrets in the global supply chain. You know, Rana Plaza, the factory that collapsed, the apparel factory that collapsed now 5-6 years ago in Bangladesh, you know, that made front page news. and I dare say any major disaster like that, or you know, even not major, just major disasters, but supply chain issues like child labor in the chocolate supply chain, you know, in cocoa grown in West Africa. That stuff inevitably surfaces. And so corporate America has become increasingly interested in fair trade and things like it for three reasons. Number one, simply to get greater visibility, transparency, and traceability into their supply chain. They want to know what's going on. They want to know what their risk is in terms of, you know, those kinds of scandals, right? So there's kind of a reputational risk mitigation desire to do fair trade or any kind of certification similar that will, you know, help create transparency in the supply chain, number one. Number two, then supply chain security, right? Supply chain disruptions are like front page news these days, right? For a lot of reasons. But suffice to say, what so many brands and retailers have discovered is if you pay more money to your suppliers, they're more loyal and they're more likely to deliver what they promise on time and at the right quality. And so many of our corporate partners, and now we're working with 1,400 companies in the US, and many of them see fair trade as a way to strengthen that global supply chain and just create more reliability in terms of the products that they're sourcing, whether it's coffee or t-shirts or anything else. And then the third attribute I would say is that increasingly companies are looking for ways to differentiate their brand and tell a story to the consumer around, you know, their values and who they are, what they stand for, and what they're doing in the realm of sustainability and worker well-being, right? We know that there's been a dramatic increase in consumer interest in sustainability and in products that are kind of consistent with our values. We know that millennials and Gen Z consumers index particularly high in this regard in terms of their expectations that companies will do the right thing and not screw the environment or the worker, right? And so companies are responding. And again, fair trade is one way that they can do that because we have that seal. So it's not just like doing good in the supply chain, it's then also putting the fair trade certified seal on the package as a way to tell stories to the consumer and get rewarded for their good works, right? To get rewarded for caring. And, you know, so I actually interviewed John Mackey, the founder and CEO of Whole Foods yesterday for a little program that we have. And I asked him, you know, what has fair trade done for Whole Foods, you know, in the success of Whole Foods business? How have we contributed to your success? And he said, first and foremost, brand differentiation. Fair trade has helped us tell a story around how we feel about the workers and the farmers and the ecosystems in our supply chain. And it's helped us differentiate from other retailers. So I think those are all the attributes that we see. And I think all of this is part of a macro trend. John Mackey calls it conscious capitalism, right? The emergence of a macro trend where companies are increasingly getting beyond the trade-off mentality of the past. You know, the trade-off mentality of the past of corporate America was either I'm maximizing profits or I'm doing something for sustainability, but I can't really do both. There's a conflict there. And I think smart capitalists, conscious capitalists today realize that actually, no, that's a false trade-off, that actually sustainability and responsibility, ethical sourcing and profitability and the success of the firm, they actually go together. And especially as we look into the future.
Yeah. And of course, I think the way consumer interests, tastes, motivations have evolved in step with that. And, you know, there's probably, maybe you know the answer. To me, it's sort of a chicken and the egg, you know, what came first. But I feel like the more there have been options like fair trade, like Whole Foods, well, I mean, there's always going to be a large segment for whom price is obviously material and decisive because it's just sometimes a means of, you know, a question of survival and whatnot. But for those consumers where, you know, they have the financial flexibility to make, have a broader, you know, number of choices to make decisions where they're not just looking at price point, but are considering, you know, source, origin, story, values, and so forth. It seems like the more options there are, the more that it grows and the more it can be a profit center, you know, for a for a business, where a line of products can grow disproportionate to what they might, you know, without. Is there more to it than that? I mean, do you see other things happening kind of on the consumer side, particularly looking ahead? You know, we're coming out of a wild ride here with this pandemic and everything. And I'm wondering what, you know, if you were to try to look around the corner, what's next kind of on the consumer front?
Look, I think it's clear that consumers are increasingly interested in what they eat, what they buy, what they wear. And they're increasingly voting with their dollars for the world that they want to see. They're spending their dollars on companies that they believe in. And this is not 100% of consumers. I asked John, how big is the conscious consumer segment? John Mackey from Whole Foods, I asked him that yesterday. He said they believe it's about 25% of all consumers. There's research on this. Some people say it's a third to a half of all consumers. It doesn't matter. What's clear is that there's a macro trend in place. So whether it's a quarter of all consumers or half of all consumers, what millennials and Gen Z preferences teach us is that in the future, responsible business, responsible sourcing, paying attention to workers, paying attention to climate change, that will be the new normal. And so some companies are leading that and others will follow. But, you know, if we look at the next, not year or two, if we look at the next 10, 20, 30 years, it is clear that corporate America and consumers together will completely change our experience. And I have no doubt whatsoever that consumers are going to continue to kind of vote with their dollars, as it were, for those companies and those products that are delivering, you know, not just quality at a decent price, but that are also delivering social and the social and environmental and health attributes that we're all looking for. So I feel very encouraged. I feel very hopeful and optimistic, actually, about our collective future, precisely because of the consumer demand piece.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and let me just say, too, this is a statement against interest, but Paul Rice talking to John Mackey sounds like a really cool discussion. Is that out yet? Or if I wanted to try and find that and listen to it, where should I go?
You know, actually, you're not going to be happy with the answer. That was an internal for the Fair Trade team interview that John graciously gifted to us. So it was the monthly all staff meeting at Fairtrade USA. I had, you know, I have roughly 140 people on my team, and I invited John to come in. And I mean, there's nothing secret about what he said. It was actually really cool. It would have been cool to have it public, but that'll have to be in the next round. Maybe you can invite us back, Scott, and John and I will do a podcast with you, because it was a fun, you know, John is truly a visionary, and in his 40 years at Whole Foods, he's turned vision into reality and made healthy eating part of American mainstream. I have huge respect and regard for him. And Whole Foods is, as you might guess, one of the number one retailers of fair trade products in America. But what's really interesting is the ripple effect, right? Because you'd guess, I can get fair trade at Whole Foods, but as a result of their example and their ripple effect, as of this year, for example, Walmart is the number one seller of fair trade tomatoes in the world. Hmm. So by succeeding at Whole Foods, we kind of won the right to work with Walmart and Costco and Kroger and Safeway and all the other retailers. So it's really cool to see how leader brands, or we call them lighthouse brands and retailers, how they end up catalyzing a much bigger ripple effect of change in the economy.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and you know, and that's a nice setup for, I think, last question, because I know we got to get you out of here, because you got still a lot of work to do in your day. But so first of all, sounds like an awesome perk for those who work at Fairtrade, getting to hear, you know, you and John chat. I'm absolutely game to have the both of you on, and I'll just turn the microphone on and sit back and let you guys go. I think that'll be my contribution to the discussion.
Nice.
But next year, that'd be a fun thing to revisit if we can swing it. But then finally, you know, there's another piece to it, Paul, which is separate and apart from fair trade itself. You know, you founded an organization, you've led that organization now going on its 23rd year. That involves knowing a lot about fair trade, but it also involves having to do a lot of other stuff, from ordinary management to developing strategy to, you know, all that goes into it. I'm wondering what some of your big lessons have been, what you might impart to others who have that entrepreneurial spirit and are looking to do something, that who might be listening and who, you know, might want to know, all right, how do I pull something off like what Paul did?
That's a fun question. You know, I would say as a founder, it's super important to be willing to evolve what you started, not to get too wed to your assumptions or to what worked for you in the past, to always be willing to improve on your work and to recognize that what got you here won't get you there. And that's very much what we're trying to do at Fair Trade. We're building on 23 years of success, but trying to evolve the model to create even more impact for even more people than ever before. Sometimes as a founder, you know, the organization is your baby and you feel protective and want to preserve, but it's absolutely about change and evolution and improvement in my mind to be successful over the long term. And as a leader, I would say you got to invest in your people. It's all about the team. You know, I mean, I'm certainly more visible than my team because I'm the founder and the CEO. But the reality is that all the glory, all the success that we have achieved as an organization is because we have such amazing team members who pour so much time and effort and passion and creativity into their work. And so, you know, as a leader, one of the biggest jobs is getting out of people's way, empowering the team to really advance the cause. And I just feel so privileged and grateful to be able to work with such amazing, talented, passionate, mission-driven people like the ones that have come to our organization. And, you know, I guess finally, I would say anyone who wants to be a change maker and a social entrepreneur achieving social and environmental objectives, you got to play the long game. And know that social change is slow, and you know, it happens over decades, not years or quarters. And so, being able to play the long game, being able to stick with it, and to run the marathon, as it were, means practicing self-care. And so often, I think ambitious entrepreneurs, social entrepreneurs, we tend to flame out and get exhausted. And you know, especially for a social entrepreneur seeking to change the world, self-preservation, self-care that allows you to stay in it year after year is absolutely essential. I've been doing this for 23 years. And honestly, Scott, I'm more fired up than ever. I'm more fired up than ever for our mission and for the huge potential for impact. And there's just no way that I would have the energy and the excitement that I do today after 23 years of doing this if I wasn't kind of a radical practitioner of self-care. I do my yoga. I take my time off. I play with my kids. I've got my hobbies and my sports. You know, I meditate. I do everything I can to stay sane and healthy and strong for the long term. And, you know, that would be my advice to other change makers, because I see so many people working so hard and burning out. And ultimately, that doesn't serve the cause.
That's great, Paul. You know, I think that last point really is harder to put into practice than folks might think, but I think couldn't be more important. And I know you got to go. And in fact, I got to go too, because speaking of, I am next due at the dojo. I study martial arts with my kids. Woo-hoo! We have a belt test tonight. So as soon as we're done, I've got to stretch out and change and, you know, see if I can keep up with two rapidly growing children as I rapidly age in front of them. So
so fun. You know,
self-care well, all the way. Brother.
And listen, thank you so much for having me on your show. I'm really grateful for everything you do, Scott, to make the world better. And just honored that you brought me on today to share some remarks and excited to see what comes of it.
Paul, it's always great to learn from you, learn from Fair Trade, and to, you know, be a part of that. It helps us on our work a great deal. So this was great. We'll stay in touch. We'll have you back next year to check in. And maybe we'll be able to do it in person and not have to be separated by so many miles here. But Paul, thanks again. Awesome to have you on.
Thank you, Scott.
LookFar is a U.S. 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to defending wild and wondrous places and working with the people living in and among them. More at lookfar.org.